From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the extra warm waters of the Caribbean and the Gulf are serving up an assembly line of hurricanes, how this is tied to climate change.
A higher proportion of hurricanes are going to reach those highest categories, category 5, or as the temperatures rise.
A divorce case out of Denton has revived a contentious debate over whether frozen embryos are people.
We don't know where we stand exactly, because there's not a statute in the state of Texas addressing that. There's not a Texas Supreme Court case addressing that specifically. I think that's up in the air.
And if necessity is the mother of invention, they're getting extra inventive with Texas rural health care. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. As of Friday, the forecast for Beryl is up in the air, but it looks like there will be a South Texas landfall on Sunday night. If that happens, there will be significant impacts in South Texas, including strong winds, heavy rains, and storm surge along the coast. That's the same coastline that was impacted by circulation around Tropical Storm Alberto just a month ago. In May, NOAA predicted the highest number of storms, hurricanes, and major hurricanes ever for this season. The National Weather Agency's forecast was for 4 to 7 major hurricanes of Category 3 or higher. The damage that high-powered storms deliver to the Texas coast is not limited to the winds, storm surge, and flooding rainfall, but also the spreading of toxic chemicals. Luke Metzger, the executive director of Environment Texas, says Texas needs to prepare for the onslaught of these storms with stronger safeguards for the oil and chemical industry.
The most important precautions are over human health and safety. I think people living in some of those coastal areas that could be most impacted from storm surge or high winds need to be prepared to evacuate if it comes to it. But then as an environmental group, we're also looking at the kind of secondary impacts that can come from storms like this. And that's everything from, of course, the flooding that could kill or injure people, as well as the kind of collection of the toxic brew that could hurt people and make them sick. We know that when this flooding happens, it can overwhelm, industrial stormwater ponds, which are, full of toxic chemicals. Right now we have to see, exactly where it hits Texas. When we see storms hit farther north, Corpus Christi, Houston area with that, huge collection of petrochemical facilities, those often will have, unauthorized releases of pollution. Millions of pounds, can be released in just a matter of hours or days. And that could also, people are breathing some of those toxic chemicals, cause health problems too.
Beyond Beryl, we know that we are looking at one of the most active hurricane seasons ever predicted, and that if it's not going to be Beryl, then it could be something else. But we don't really plan and prepare for huge storms hitting some of these areas that contain all of this toxic waste, all these toxic substances. And so, but then when it does happen, there are a few safeguards that are in place. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of our industrial facilities are not prepared for this kind of extreme weather creating those kinds of safeguards to prevent, any toxic materials on their facilities, entering either in the air or into floodwaters. And that's why, it's critical that industry be doing far more, both to reduce the pollution that's fueling the climate crisis, but also to reduce their impact to public safety in the case of extreme weather.
So let's talk about the impact of climate change and what we're dealing with hurricane season in Texas, including Beryl. Obviously, the Gulf waters and the Caribbean waters are warmer than usual, record-breaking temperatures being clocked in these waters at times now. How is that creating the situation connected to climate change with this extreme weather in Texas?
the case of hurricanes, you know, they are formed through the combination of warmer water, which, as you point out, the Atlantic Ocean and all of our oceans are much warmer, you know, today than they were 100 years ago, as well as moist air and then converging winds. And so as our oceans get hotter, the hurricanes and storms can pick up more energy, which enables higher wind speeds and can cause more damage.
Which is why we have, you know, Beryl was a Category 5 hurricane at one point. That was the earliest that has ever been recorded in a calendar year.
Exactly right. And, you know, we're seeing ocean heat content right now at levels that are usually not seen until September. You know, usually the oceans, you know, are at their peak temperature after heating up all summer long, but we're already seeing temperatures like that now. You know, that's why, you know, both with Beryl and in the future, you know, we expect that the higher proportion of hurricanes are going to reach those highest categories, you know, Category 5, 4, et cetera, as the temperatures rise.
But many people in Texas are looking at Beryl and going, yeah, come to Texas because we need the water. The state has been dealing with an extreme drought for quite a while, which is also a result of climate change. So we're dealing with these two issues.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, as the temperature increases, then we also, you know, see more evaporation and thus more drought. Which then, you know, leaves us more vulnerable to water shortages. It can also fuel the rise in wildfires, you know, like we saw with the Smokehouse Creek fire earlier this year. We're just seeing more and more very large, dangerous wildfires, all resulting from those same conditions.
Meanwhile, the state of Texas continues to deny that climate change is real. If they do acknowledge that climate change is real, they will not admit that it's man-made or has anything to do with the release of carbon fuels into the atmosphere. And the Railroad Commission, which is in charge of petroleum industry, pretty much, they are asking to be put in charge of the state's efforts to carbon capture. That's being criticized as putting the fox in charge of the hen house. The Texas Railroad Commission, of course, has a lot of ethical concerns. Some people are wondering if the Railroad Commission should be in charge of trying to protect the state from climate change when it doesn't even acknowledge that it exists.
Yeah, and we're among those critics. You know, we've not only do they not even acknowledge that climate change exists, they have a very poor track record of just dealing with, you know, the environmental safety around their existing oil wells. You know, a lot of leaks. And serious kind of health problems associated with that. The Environmental Protection Agency is now investigating the Railroad Commission over some of those complaints. It seems that, you know, that combination of just, you know, poor track record of putting the interests of the, you know, oil industry profits ahead of, you know, proper, you know, plugging of wells and proper management of wells, clearly shows that they shouldn't be in charge of, you know, this even more dangerous substance, carbon dioxide, because, you know, I think the hope is that we can safely store it underground, but the technology is still pretty nascent, hasn't really been done at scale. And there's, you know, a risk if we don't do it properly, there could be just a catastrophic release of carbon dioxide, which, you know, could both certainly be bad for the climate, but also to the people that live near those storage sites.
But also there's a high level of trust that's involved in this process. When these energy companies are asking or will be receiving federal dollars for sequestering the carbon, how do we know that they're actually going to provide the services that they're going to be paid for, especially when their regulator in this was the Railroad Commission, which is compromised?
Exactly. You know, they, you know, been many cases where, you know, the commissioners have taken, you know, hundreds of thousand dollar donations, you know, right ahead of a vote, you know, over, you know, the a company's permit. And so clearly demonstrating conflicts of interest. And so when you're dealing with, you know, stakes this high, you know, that trust is so critical. And that's why, you know, we think the Environmental Protection Agency would be the better manager of such a program.
Luke Metzger is the Executive Director of Environment Texas. As we face this extremely active hurricane season, there is the possibility of extended periods of power outages. That puts a vulnerable population at risk, seniors. Houston Public Media's Colleen De Guzman reports that while some senior care centers are highly regulated and are prepared, independent living communities are not much different than your average apartment complex.
My air went out on the 7th, and they brought me a little AC unit, a portable unit that's in my bedroom.
Rosie Powell's AC went out on the 7th, June 7th. Another week, and it'll be a month of living without cool air.
How hot is it in your apartment right now?
Let me see. 86. I just try to, you know, brace myself and try to have enough food or water around here to take care of me.
Powell is 71. Even though she lives in Palisades of Inwood, a senior living complex in North Houston, it doesn't mean she has a safety net.
It's just like a regular apartment complex.
Amy Peck is a Houston City Council member. She explains there are several kinds of senior living facilities. The types listed as independent are not required to provide special care to seniors, even though they're marketed to people older than 55.
A lot of times there are a bunch of senior citizens living in an apartment complex with no kind of accountability for what could happen in a disaster situation.
Seniors often live with chronic health problems and rely on power to keep life-saving devices charged and medications at the right temperature. State Senator Molly Cook holds a master's in public health, and she said as people age, they're more at risk for dehydration.
Especially if it's humid, that could be lethal to them.
Storms in May caught Houstonians by surprise, leaving many without power or AC for days, including senior care communities. It became a test of who is prepared for hurricane season.
Because what we saw out there was that folks were falling between the gaps.
That gap Cook is talking about is the different regulations between the different types of senior facilities. Centers that offer medical care, such as nursing homes and assisted living centers, are required to be storm ready. Chuck LaLonda is a senior vice president of operations for Belmont Village Senior Living, which has two assisted living and memory care facilities in Houston. They're required by the state to have things such as a generator, enough food and water for each resident for at least 3 days, and an evacuation plan.
It's a pretty strict list that we follow, so we're not reinventing the wheel every hurricane season.
But these centers can cost up to $7,000 a month, which few seniors can afford. Meanwhile, independent living communities are much cheaper and regulated much like an average apartment complex.
Keep in mind that for our target populations, they all have to be able to take care of their own needs or they can't live in the properties.
That's Linda Holder, Executive Director for the Housing Corporation, a nonprofit with 8 independent living communities in Houston. She says it's all in the name, independent living.
Again, independent living. We really can't take care of people's medical needs.
Right.
There's always 911.
Mm-hmm.
We are very high profile with the fire department.
Yes, we are.
Despite that, Holder says they do stock extra food and water and provide a cooling center when power goes out. Reality is, even though these seniors are expected to be independent, they often need help. Holder said many of her residents are low income, on medication, and not always able to walk on their own. Amy Peck, with City Council, is now looking into drafting local policies to regulate independent living communities.
You know, that there has to at least be some kind of minimum standard of care at these apartment complexes.
Meanwhile, Rosie, who we heard from earlier in this story, is still waiting for her AC to get fixed.
I'm sitting here in the living room now with my little portable fan that I had bought from Walmart.
I'm Colleen De Guzman in Houston.
Tar has made its way to the Texas beaches once again this summer. Originating from the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, some of it is naturally occurring. Some of it is also from oil spills and shipwrecks. The tar is a reoccurring phenomenon from Galveston to South Padre Island, and the incoming barrel may bring more of it to the shore. For Texas Public Radio, Gage Davila heads to South Padre to tell us more.
Last month was the 45th anniversary of an oil spill off the Bay of Campeche that made its way here to South Padre Island. 4,000 metric tons of oil coated Texas's beaches, leaving the tourism-dependent town mostly empty for about a year. A current change saved the Texas coast from more tar in 1980. Currents also brought tar to this city's beaches this June. But where did it come from? Tony Reisinger is Cameron County's Marine Extension agent.
First of all, the tar comes out of the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. There's so much pressure of the water, of the Gulf, on the seafloor that it gets squeezed up. And it comes up either as asphalt or tar, or as oil, as crude oil.
Reisinger spent the last month checking the beaches for tar. It wasn't hard to find the last few weeks. It's a testament to how much tar is in the Gulf.
Over 500,000 barrels, that's the low number, to I think 1.4 million barrels come up annually into the Gulf of Mexico. That's a lot.
The Texas General Land Office, or GLO, sent samples from tar they found this summer for analysis to Texas A&M. The results showed it was weathered crude oil, confirming that it likely came from the bottom of the Gulf and not an oil spill.
But when there is a spill, it leaves a fingerprint on that oil, man.
Raymond Oliveira is the director of the GLO's Oil Response and Prevention Division for South Texas. He noted that the incoming high tides from Hurricane Beryl will likely push whatever tar is left to the dunes. As of now, there's trace amounts of tar left on the beach after Tropical Storm Alberto's landfall 2 weeks ago and a cleanup effort by the GLO and the city of South Padre Island. The GLO recommends using baby oil or dish soap to remove tar from skin. A solvent like WD-40 can be used to remove tar from shoes. For Texas Public Radio, I'm Gage Davila on South Padre Island.
In vitro fertilization is one of the most common assistive procedures for people looking to conceive. Unlike the Alabama Supreme Court, the Texas Appeals Court says frozen embryos like the ones created through IVF are not legally children. Anti-abortion groups say an unborn child is a child, whether they're in the womb or outside of it. The Texas Supreme Court stayed silent on the Denton's couple divorce dispute over embryos created through in vitro fertilization. That leaves a lower court's decision in place, which is that frozen embryos aren't legally children. KERA's Tolowani Osobamowo reports that it now may be up to the Texas lawmakers to further clarify the state rules around IVF.
Texas abortion law defines an embryo as an unborn child from fertilization onward. Because of that reasoning, Denton mother Caroline Anton said the IVF embryos she and her ex-husband Gabriel created should be treated as children, not property. A Fort Worth appeals court said the definition of an unborn child does not include a frozen embryo outside the womb. Nathan Seltzer is with the Justice Foundation, a nonprofit that opposes abortion. He says the decision shows a disconnect between the rights given to embryos in the courts versus the law.
It's inconsistent for Texas law to treat a child outside the womb differently from a child inside the womb who's effectively the same age.
Fertility centers in Alabama temporarily stopped offering IVF services after their state Supreme Court ruled embryos are people and that someone who destroys them could be liable for a wrongful death. But Alabama lawmakers quickly moved to protect clinics from criminal and civil penalties. According to Texas law, if embryos are lawfully destroyed in a medical procedure with the required consent, anyone involved in the process is protected from liability and prosecution. Seltzer says that means IVF access was never at risk in Texas, as some feared in Alabama. He says it's a matter of holding the IVF industry responsible.
When we're talking about human beings and whether how they're going to be treated and what's going to happen to them, then we need the law to step in.
But others say a ruling that puts embryos through the child custody process, as suggested, would make IVF a lot more complicated. Chad Ruback is an appellate lawyer in Dallas. He says liability for death is a risk. Courts might even need to decide visitation rights for couples and embryos.
Could that case law be made applicable to a fertility clinic that has custody of frozen embryos? I don't know. But I think there's going to be a lot of issues that are going to need to be considered.
It would also cast doubt on the legality of IVF contracts. And there are other questions. Could clinics be required to preserve frozen embryos indefinitely to avoid destroying them or be forced to implant them all at once? Medical experts say neither option is practical. So where does Texas stand on the legal personhood of frozen embryos? The law itself is still unclear.
Because there's not a statute in the state of Texas addressing that. There's not a Texas Supreme Court case addressing that specifically. I think that's up in the air.
Also up in the air, whether state lawmakers will file bills next year clearly spelling out how the law classifies frozen embryos. State Representative Mihaela Plisa, a Democrat from Plano, encouraged the public to sign a petition asking lawmakers to explicitly protect IVF. Plisa has pursued fertility treatments herself.
IVF is a very personal decision. It's a very expensive decision. These are not things that women take lightly. And so, you know, we need to make sure that we let women know that we stand with them.
Some Republican state lawmakers have tried in recent years to pass IVF legislation, but none of those bills made it past committee hearings. Hunter Lewis is a family lawyer from Dallas. He says legislation getting passed depends on public concern and lawmakers actually agreeing on bills. In his view, the Anton decision is sufficiently clear in reinforcing the state's definition of an unborn child.
Having this type of clarity is really important, as is the right to contract. And so if there is a concern that your belief system doesn't align with what this is, make your voice heard.
Many people seek IVF treatment regardless of their politics, but he says that doesn't mean the procedure will be a uniting political force. I'm Tolu Wani Osibemowo in Dallas.
Texas has lost more rural hospitals than any other state, and many rural counties lack adequate primary care services. And in response to this critical challenge, mobile health clinics are rolling out to provide vital health services where they're needed most. KACU's Alexis Jones reports how these clinics could help residents in the rural areas of Texas.
On a recent sweltering day in Abilene, local officials watch as two people assemble what is essentially a mobile health clinic in the parking lot of the West Central Texas Council of Governments in less than 20 minutes. Once the structure was built, leaders from across the big country file into the unit for a sales pitch and much-needed AC. The idea of the mobile op unit was born in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina as a way to respond to emergency challenges. Mobile health clinics aren't exactly new, but this particular model is unique because it unfolds from a compact 2.5 feet into a structure that can withstand hurricane force winds while serving as everything from a medical care facility to a command center or even temporary housing.
The main problem was always real estate. Where do you actually set up at and have something set up? So these units take up only about 2.5 feet when they're folded up, so they'll take up any real estate. But when you need them, they fold back out.
That's Rick Pearson, head of design and development at the Dallas-based Mobile Op 4. Pearson says that the units are made out of recycled material and can be customized to each consumer's needs. Mobile Op 4 founder Jeff Blankenship made it clear that these units would augment healthcare in communities where they're needed most, not take away current resources.
Working with the border now, and the Border Patrol is very interested in our modules as well, not just for isolation rooms or detention, but also for they can be converted into housing.
The units can be used in various scenarios, from natural disasters to community events like concerts and fairs. They weigh under 2,000 pounds, allowing for easy towing by regular vehicles, and can function with local power or generators. Already, the modules are attracting attention from schools and rural areas lacking in adequate medical facilities. Ted Matthews, interim CEO of Anson General Hospital, said that the mobile units could add to the hospital's existing services.
We have clinics there and we have our emergency room there, but I could see on a countywide basis or perhaps even a community-wide basis where two or three entities could go in, and if we reach that point where we need that rapid response, we could team up both from the hospital as well as where the incident took place out there and set this up shortly.
Mobile Op is even working with companies like Samsung that are rethinking healthcare.
We're working with them because they're going to be utilizing our module. Samsung is developing hospitals of the future with their technology and their TVs. So we're very actively involved with different other companies that are revolutionizing hospital to the home.
The issue of needing better preventative measures and more state support for rural health care remains a problem. But it seems to be getting better thanks to ideas like Mobile Op 4. In Abilene, I'm Alexis Jones.
In some rural parts of Texas, where hospitals and doctor's offices are in short supply, people often turn to 911 just for basic medical care. Experts say that's a problem for patients and for hospitals. but a growing model called community paramedicine aims to address it by having paramedics regularly check in on people before health issues become an emergency. Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik has a look to see how one of these programs is playing out in rural West Texas.
It's a scorching hot summer day in the tiny desert town of Terlingua, Texas, where Susan Martin's the local EMS chief.
This is our apparatus bay. We do have the one ambulance. We have a rescue vehicle now that serves kind of as an all-purpose vehicle for us. It's what our community paramedics run out of when they go on calls.
Martin's small crew, fewer than 10 people, responds to 911 calls across a dusty 3,000-square-mile range of rural West Texas.
A lot of what we're seeing now with the heat is environmental, some dehydration, some heat exhaustion, things like that.
Martin says they also get calls from people with chronic health issues.
Some patients don't understand their medications. They don't make me feel good, so I don't want to take them, so I don't take them, and then I end up being a 911 call.
The closest hospital is more than an hour away, so her department's one ambulance can be tied up for a good chunk of the day on an emergency call. That's a big part of why Martin's team has launched a community paramedicine program, where paramedics regularly check in on people with known health issues, patients who might not get to the doctor as often as they should. Alexandra Hollenbeck is one of the local paramedics.
A lot of people out here, you know, they're very, like, reclusive. It tends to be older people or people with chronic illnesses, such as, like, hypertension, COPD.
A 2023 survey from a national paramedics trade group counted more than 150 of these kinds of community paramedicine programs across the country. It's a growing healthcare model championed by EMS agencies and hospitals at a time when some advocates say rural healthcare is facing a crisis. Adrian Billings is a longtime West Texas doctor and rural health expert at Texas Tech University.
This area is one of the most under-resourced healthcare areas in our state.
Billings says for patients, routine paramedicine check-ins at home can avoid expensive emergency room visits. Hospitals want to avoid that too. They can face penalties when too many patients come back to the ER soon after release. That's called a readmission.
From a financial standpoint, community paramedicine programs do help cut down on readmissions that can be very costly for hospitals.
One KFF Health News analysis from 2022 tallied $320 million in hospital readmission penalties nationwide. But even though paramedicine programs can save big on costs, preventative care like this requires an upfront investment.
The economic model for EMS-based community paramedicine is very challenging.
That's Matt Zawadzki, a longtime emergency medicine professional in Texas who now works for a national consulting firm for EMS operations. He says insurance providers, Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurers mostly don't cover paramedics making house calls.
So we've got EMTs and paramedics all over the country who are doing the right thing by trying to work with patients to prevent unnecessary emergency department visits, but yet they're not eligible for reimbursement.
The new paramedicine program in small-town Terlingua is being funded as part of a broader $5 million U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Development Grant, with no guarantees for long-term funding.
Being able to prove to the payers that these programs are economically more efficient than a 911 call to the emergency department is going to be crucial for those rural communities to sustain these outstanding programs.
Zawadzki hopes that with time and data, community paramedicine programs will be able to prove their worth to healthcare insurers.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org, and you can download us wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.